Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. Unfortunately, we're together today because Galt McDermott has passed away. I spoke to him in December of 2007, December 15th, almost exactly 11 years ago now. One of the very first interviews I did on WFMU, and perhaps you'll hear a slightly less polished me, but I certainly was enthusiastic and happy to talk to him, and just a unique musical voice and an interesting body of work, and hopefully this provides a window on all of that to you. Just a reminder, there's some interesting stuff coming up. Check WFMU.org/Michael for the archives and the list of upcoming stuff. And while I've got you here, I just wish you all a happy new year, a sane, safe, stress-free holiday season. For me, good music is a huge part of staying stress-free. And I will be back next year to talk with you. Here it is, me and Galt McDermott from 2007. Yeah, there is Woe Is Me from Galt McDermott, and I believe joining us on the phone right now. Galt, welcome to WFMU. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Great. We've just been listening to about 25 minutes or so of music with your name on it in one way or another. It's really very interesting music. It sounds like you. I don't even know you, but there's such a stamp on it.
Well, what was that last piece? I recognize the music, but I don't remember the name.
Woe Is Me.
Woe, oh, from Shakespeare, yeah. From Hamlet.
Ah, very interesting. You're born in Montreal, Canada.
Right.
And tell me, what were you listening to as a kid? What were your folks listening to? Was there music in your house?
Oh, yeah. My father was a very good piano player. He played jazz and he played everything, classics. And we used to play duets together, you know.
And when did you start playing?
Well, I started on the violin when I was a kid. I mean, I don't know, six or something like that. And then when I was around 11, I started hearing Boogie Woogie. And jazz, you know, Duke Ellington, that type of stuff. And I switched to the piano. Mm.
And were you a natural? Was it hard?
I was natural at some things. I mean, certain things I didn't take to. I didn't. There was a certain kind of classical music that left me cold. I've learned to like it since. But when music, you know, when I liked it, I got it.
Mm. Was it? Yeah. So when you heard something in your head, you could
play it.
Turn it. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much. I don't really remember the process, but I do know switching over to the piano took a bit of an effort.
Hmm. I guess you were a teenager in the 1940s during the war years.
Right.
Music was very interesting during that time. What were you? Were you studying? Were you into, you know, what other teenagers were into?
Well, yeah, you know, I went to dances, and the music that we danced to was really good music. I mean, it was all. Jazz guys, really. I mean, the Ellington Basie and those big bands, and then Errol Garner and Charlie Parker, all that stuff. That's what I listened to.
Mm.
And we all listened to it. Everybody liked it. I mean, and then, of course, it fell apart sort of in the 50s.
Yeah. Rock and roll ruined everything.
No, it died before rock and roll. We had that soupy stuff, you know, for about 5 years, and then Presley came in, and I think he revived music. No, he didn't kill it.
Yeah, well, I would tend to agree. 1950, your dad gets a job, the High Commissioner to South Africa from Canada, I believe.
That's right.
And you move to Cape Town. You know, that's a long way from Montreal. Yeah. What happened there?
Well, I took a degree in music. I said, I got to get this music down cold. I mean, I wasn't really good enough to make a living at it, I didn't think. So I wanted a couple of years, you know, to practice up. So I took a degree, a Bachelor of Music, and I learned to play the organ. And actually, my first job was in a church, playing for hymns and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Was the education, you know, just a sort of a white English type of education, or was it, you know, was there a South African native element to it as well?
Well, you know, there was apartheid down there.
Right.
I mean, it had only been in a year when I got there, which was around 50. And it didn't bother me. We used to go out and listen to the guys listen to the bands and watch the acts at the what they called locations, which is where the Africans lived. And it was never a problem. I could hear as much of that stuff and that's really why I went to Africa. I wanted to hear that stuff.
What was it like? I mean, I assume during the day you're in class getting this book education, at night you're out getting this full other musical side of the coin.
Well, it's all music, you know. I wanted to know what the hell the old guys did, Mozart and those people. And I was also interested in what the Africans were doing, because that was the music that moved me.
Hmm. And what were they doing?
They were dancing to any damn thing they could. I mean, you couldn't go out of the house without hearing some guy singing something or playing a guitar or dancing. I mean, when they did a job, like, you know, making a road or something, they would all sing it. It was great.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I sort of hear that in your music, but I hear sort of all the music we've talked about so far. Is that accurate, you think?
Well, I guess it is. I'm not conscious of what what I'm doing when I do it now, but I'm sure that stuff all influenced me.
Yeah, because a lot of your music, I hear accents in what's unusual places.
Well...
Maybe it's me.
You know, African music is contrapuntal. It's all counter-rhythm. I mean, there's rhythms going against each other all the time. And so that makes these accents come in, in odd places. And I find it very exciting stuff.
Yeah, very exciting stuff. After Africa, like you said, you started working as an organist in a church and playing with a couple of bands, including a calypso band, and you sort of got into writing music for plays, for musicals, and I think that led to your first recording deal. This would be the mid-1950s, and you recorded the tune African Waltz.
Right, that's right.
Which turns out to be a giant, giant hit a few years later. I think it gets recorded by Johnny Dankworth, right?
And Cannonball Adderley.
And then Cannonball Adderley has, in 1961, I looked it up, it was actually a number 64 hit single. And it was just one of these records that sort of crossed, everyone wanted to hear that record. I mean, it was a huge, huge record.
Yeah, it was a good hit record. I mean, I on the basis of the finance of it, I quit the church.
Well, I'm glad to hear you got paid, at least.
I got paid. Nothing huge, but it was certainly... It was better than what I was making in the church.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing about jazz records at that time. Things sort of could become a standard and get recorded many, many times by different artists, you know, because guys like Cannonball Adderley probably put out two or three records a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people ended up recording that tune, and you end up winning a Grammy for it.
Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, I didn't know anything about the music business in those days. That was all a surprise to me. But I went over to England then, you know, to meet Johnny Dank. Well, actually, I'd met him before when I gave him my record. But I found it hard to make a living in England. That was when the Beatles and rock and roll was really taking hold. And I had no problem with rock and roll, but by that time I was in my 30s. I was too old to really be a performer.
You moved, I guess England just didn't work for you. You moved back to New York City.
No, you get 10 shillings for playing a night, you know, and I didn't know how to proceed from there. So I went back to Montreal, and then I said, okay, I'm going down to New York. That's where real music is. And we did. I had a couple of kids by that time.
You met some guys who, a lot of them you're still playing with today, guys who sort of became, guys who sort of spoke the same language as you.
Yeah, but you know, that was, I got here in 64, 65, and I met a guy called Rick Shorter, who's a cousin of Wayne Shorter. He was a record producer. And he liked my piano playing, so he would hire me to, you know, make demos for publishers, and that's where I met Purdy and Jimmy Lewis and a whole bunch of great, great players.
Yeah, why is Bernard Purdy such a special drummer? I mean, he's really a special musician.
He really is. I don't know what makes a person special. He just has wonderful ears, and he's always inventive, and he's just. Terrific drummer.
Yeah. Is he a nice guy?
Lovely guy. Oh. Yeah. Couldn't ask for a nicer guy.
Well, that's good to hear. So you recorded this record, Shapes of Rhythm, which we just heard a few songs from 1966. It's really a timeless-sounding record to me.
Well, thank you.
You know what I mean? Partly because it's recorded in a very matter-of-fact way, so the technology doesn't obscure the music.
No, I mean, I was a piano player, so, you know, piano is an acoustic instrument, so you really don't mess with it too much, or at least, Rick Shorter actually produced that. He was in the sound booth listening to it and putting it together, but it, you know, 1960, not much, and I think we were still doing two tracks or something.
What were your expectations at that point of being a solo music maker? Because, you know, it's not quite jazz. It's not quite R&B.
No. Well, it's hard to say. I had no expectations. All I was doing was going from one moment to the other. You know, and I had these songs. I'd written a bunch of songs which I wanted to record, so that's what I did.
And you put them out on your own label, which still thrives to this day, Kilmarnock. And at that point, were you living in Staten Island?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we came to Staten Island. When we moved from Montreal, somebody was subletting a place here, and we just moved here. And I found it very convenient to be here.
Yeah. Staten Island's kind of an unknown treasure. Parts of it are.
It's called the Arcane Borough, right.
Yeah. And I guess soon after that, you met the guys who were writing or putting together the musical Hair, right?
Well, there was a guy called Nat Shapiro who wrote a book called Hear Me Talking to You. Do you know that book?
Mm-mm.
It's about interviews with jazz musicians, and I had read the book and liked it. And a friend of mine in England told me, look up Nat Shapiro when you go over there, because he really knows the music business. And he put me together with these two writers. I told him I wanted to write a musical. I figured, you know, that's something to do.
Why not? Well, you picked a good one. Jerome Ragney and Jim Rado,
right.
They were actors. They were just creative guys around town, it seems like. Had they just written lyrics on a sheath of paper and handed it to you?
No, it wasn't like that. They had written the lyrics, and they'd written the play. I mean, all the dialogue and everything was written, and the lyrics were written, and I read it, and I said, oh, this is funny. I thought it was funny. And then they said, well, we need the songs because we got to play it to Joe Papp. And so I wrote about maybe half a dozen or 10 songs, and then we played it to Joe Papp, and Joe said, oh, sure, I'll do this.
Mm. Galt McDermott is my guest. Galt, tell me a little bit about the process. I mean, how do you sit down and come up with the right music for the right lyrics?
Well, I mean, we talked a little bit about it. They said they wanted a rock and roll score. And I said, well, that's fine. That's exactly what I do, because I was doing all these rock and roll demo records. And so I just tried to, but I really didn't try. I just did what came naturally, really. And, you know, you sit in front of a lyric and you hear it. Either you hear it or you go home and try it again the next day.
Were they bowled over when they first heard it? Because I understand that they went through a few folks, composers, trying to find the right match.
They did, yeah. I didn't know the other guys, but apparently they had talked to different people. But I don't know if they were bowled over. No, they seemed to be very enthusiastic. Yeah, they were nice. And they can sing. They could both perform. Hmm. And they learned the songs, and we performed them. It was really quite good.
The Public Theater ran for 8 weeks. Then it moved to a disco called the Cheetah for a couple months, and then it moved to Broadway, where it lasted for years.
Yeah, that's right.
It was it's like a cultural milestone. It really is. I mean, that was such a turbulent, weird time for America, and there's no way people can't include Hair in, you know, it's so close to, or at least to what is perceived now as reflecting what exactly was going on.
Well, I think it did. I mean, the two guys, Rado and Ragney, were very in tune with the hippie movement and the sort of had a free attitude to everything. And they were very hip guys. I mean, they were excellent lyric writers, and they were funny. So, and also they were concerned about the war and about, you know, things that were interesting people at the time.
Yeah, civil rights, things like that. It was really a provocative show, and it was also sort of a way to get, you know, the blue-haired folks to listen, you know?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, they did come. People came to it.
Oh, yeah. All over the world people came. There were productions of this all over the world.
Well, strangely enough, there still are. You know, there's two in Germany, one in Holland, I mean, and one in Norway, I just heard about the other day. So people still do it, and I'm not sure why exactly.
I guess some of those same issues are still relevant. One of the most amazing things about the songs, and I think there's like 32 or 33 songs ended up being written for the show,
right.
Is that in the great Broadway show tradition, you know, since the beginning of Broadway, folks, that has really been a source of popular songs. People would cover those songs and have actual giant hits with them. And here, the songs, I mean, the covers are endless, instrumental versions and vocal versions as well.
Yeah.
Cow Seals had a number two hit with Hair in 69. Oliver had a number three hit in 69 with Good Morning Starshine. Nina Simone, we heard her Hair thing. It kind of goes on and on. Was it a surprise to you that the songs would be so part of everything?
Well, I don't know if it was a surprise because, you know, you don't write these shows to hide them. You know, I was very gratified that people were liking it, but it didn't really surprise me because I liked them.
Yeah, they're great.
And I thought, well, if I like them, why shouldn't somebody else?
Yeah, perfect. I had Bones Howe on a couple weeks ago. He produced the Fifth Dimension.
Yeah, I remember him. Sure.
And he says that he just had the idea to put that medley together himself. Was that the kind of, was it like a sacrilege thing to you? When you heard it, did you go, wow, this is great?
No, that didn't bother me. I thought it was a natural thing to do.
Yeah.
Because we did quite a bit of it in the show. We backed shows, songs back to back.
Right. When I hear that Fifth Dimension record, to me, it's a hit record from the first.
Yeah.
That weird stuff in the beginning. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's no question that that is just a giant hit record. And that won a Grammy as well for Best Record of the Year. Your mind must have been, in some ways, going crazy.
No, well, maybe I just am crazy. But, I, you know, it seemed fairly normal to me. I, you know, what was happening seemed the way things should be. And, of course, they're not always like that.
Yeah, well, it's nice when the good guys, you know, get into the mainstream. So you obviously must have made some money from Hair. I would hope that you did well. And a lot of that you plowed back into the label and releasing records by folks in your circle and yourself and building up the catalog of your record label.
Well, I mean, you know, you write music, but you really don't hear it until you've recorded it or performed it. So if I never really had a relationship with a record company. RCA did the Hair, but that was about all. And then I just, whatever records I wanted to make, I did.
Mm. You did a lot of soundtracks, including Cotton Comes to Harlem, which is a really interesting movie.
Yeah.
Tell me the process there. Would you read the script, or would you get to actually watch a rough cut when you would start the process?
I don't really remember reading a script. I met with Sam Goldin, who was the producer, and we talked about the movie. And then I think I took it. I looked at the movie.
Mm.
They shot most of it, and. I liked the movie. It was great.
Yeah, and just start. So you just sit at the piano and start writing?
I don't know if I even. I don't remember how I did it, but I just started writing, and I used quite a few songs. I used to work with a guy called Dumaresk, who lived in England, and we'd been writing songs, you know, for years, and so I took some of those and put them in that movie.
I had Lalo Schifrin on the show once, and he said something that to him was very matter of fact, but to me, it kind of blew my mind. He said that when he composes, he just sits down with, you know, with music staff paper and a pen and composes, not necessarily at a piano, which to me seems, but he said, oh, it's just like a language, just like Spanish or anything. It's just once you learn the language, you don't need the piano in front of you.
No, well, that's true. I mean, especially songs. If I get a lyric, and look at the lyric. I hear a melody, so then I have to have a piece of paper and write it down. Sometimes on that piece of paper, you know, the same piece of paper that the lyrics on. Huh. But then it takes a bit of work. You know, you can't just hand that over to somebody. You've got to figure out the chords and all that.
Right, smooth it out a bit. So this whole time you're doing soundtracks and music for musicals like Two Gentlemen of Verona, another big hit, and you're traveling, you're raising a family, Hair is sort of continuing to get bigger and bigger, and the film comes out in 79, and you've put together the New Pulse Jazz Band, a lot of those same guys again, and you're still composing. Do you compose every day?
Well, I don't get an idea every day, but I try to. Yeah.
And apparently in the basement of your house were all these tapes and all these LP records, right?
Right.
And there's those two great compilations, Up from the Basement, which have some of just great funky tracks that...
Yeah, well, a guy called Ethan Allapat, you know, got in touch with me and went down there in the basement and listened to just about everything down there and put those two records together. Mm. And he released those on... I don't know what they're on. I think they're not on Kilmarnock.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have it in front of me. Yeah, there's some great... Some of them are just little snippets, but they're very... funky instrumental stuff. And right about that time, you get discovered by the R&B crowd, the hip-hop guys, the guys who, you know, find little two-bar
phrases.
Yeah, and they hook them together and make songs, and Busta Rhymes' platinum... Woo-ha got you all in check.
Yes.
A bunch of folks, Naughty by Nature.
Down with the King.
The Beat Nuts. There's just like, was that, I mean, that's another thing. It just sort of seems to make sense.
Well, it makes sense. I didn't even hear about it for a long time. I didn't know what was going on. And then the Busta Rhymes people called me and made a deal with my lawyer. And that was the first time. But there'd been a lot of those, I wouldn't say a lot, but several of those, you know, rap records that they used. And I kind of like what they were doing.
Yeah, it is interesting when you hear, sometimes you can really hear it, and sometimes it's slightly obscured. But, yeah, I would imagine you would be chuffed. You would, you know.
What?
That would be a interesting, I'd love it if, you know.
Well, I mean, I thought that it was nice that they liked it. You know, it's nice when somebody appreciates your music, and then they develop it. That's lovely.
Yeah, and keep it contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here, you just did a 40th anniversary production.
Right.
Which you played keyboards in. Mm-hmm. And some of the original cast came back. How was that? What was that experience
like? That was really good. They put together a great cast of young kids. And, you know, there's no better place to play a show than in a park. It's just a great place to put on a show.
Right, it was at the Delacorte Theater.
Yeah, and we had a big band. Purdy played, and Wilbur Bascom, the usual guys. And it was just a very nice show.
There's a movie that I don't know if it's completed yet or if it's coming out, Ear of the Heart, the Music of Galt McDermott.
Yeah, that's about my music. Yeah.
There's a documentary on you. I think it's coming out next year.
I don't know. I mean, I'm in touch with them, but I haven't heard of a release date yet.
On the internet says 2008. Is it finished?
I think it's sort of finished, but you know, they never stop editing and fixing it.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Is there any surprises in that?
Well, not to me. Maybe to somebody else.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. You've got a gig Monday at the West Bank Cafe here in New York City, 42nd Street west of 9th Avenue, 7:30 p.m. What can folks expect?
Well, it's a little like what you've been just playing, those mm-hmm. instrumentals. It's all instrumental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I bring in singers, but on Monday we're not doing singers.
It says, I think the website says special holiday show.
Okay.
Is there any holiday business
going
on?
My birthday is the next day, and Christmas is coming up.
Wow. Well, happy birthday. I'm glad you keep working. I've got one final song here queued up. The song is called Space.
Oh, yeah, that's Busta Rhymes' thing.
Yeah, the Busta Rhymes thing. Do you remember recording it? Do you remember writing it?
Oh, sure. I don't remember writing it. I remember recording it because we did it for a movie called A Woman is Sweeter.
Right. And like a record like this, would just record it live pretty much? Or?
Yeah, I think it was just one take. It was, you know, on that one it was Idris Muhammad playing drums.
Ah.
So it has a different feel.
Yeah, another fantastic drummer.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, another great guy. Galt McDermott, it has really been a pleasure to visit with you, and good luck with everything. I'm just, you know, one of my favorites. There's just so much great music with
thank you.
Your name attached to it. And it's Monday night at the West Bank Cafe, and we'll look for that movie. And there is lots of stuff on your website, which is galtmcdermott.com.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Galt.
Take care.